Bible geography is the course. It is the class for this quarter. And it's a challenge because how do you teach Bible geography and incorporate the most important subject, which is redemption? Are we here to talk about the height and the elevation of Mount Ararat, where Noah's Ark settled? Are we here to discuss the deep valleys and wadis, the dry wadis in the Promised Land? Those are some of the academic things you might study if you go to school, and I did, and didn't enjoy it. It's just not my thing. If you were able to go to the Is Genesis History showing the other night, one of the things that was mentioned in that presentation that I found very interesting was that the elevations and such have changed, because elevations are always changing. And using in a very small microcosm, if you will, Mount St. Helens, how drastically things can change over a short amount of time. We're not really here then to talk about elevations and depths of dry river valleys, okay? And that's my judgment on this class. What we will do is incorporate the course material and talk about topically the locations that this subject wants us to discuss. And that's what we're going to do. And so between now and Wednesday night, we are supposed to cover the material that addresses the locations, starting with the Garden of Eden and ending with the Palestine area, the land of Israel, Canaan, as it is called, in the book of Genesis. So what that means is this class will primarily be, for the next 2 weeks, or two sessions, if you will, a study in the book of Genesis. And I will have some, good, yes, excellent. And I'll need a clicker, or I can just bent, stoop down and click. How about that? That's all right, man, you're the man. Because I used to do PowerPoint all the time when I was full-time preaching, so I had to really break it out the last couple of days and decide whether or not I was still somewhat efficient. And so, anyway, okay, so study of the Bible lands, systematic study of geography and how it affects the Bible story of redemption. That's going to be the attempt, okay? This morning what we're going to talk about are three different things, and we're going to start with the Garden of Eden, and we're going to talk about that briefly. One other point we have to make when we talk about Bible geography is nothing is the same since the flood. So everything before the flood is pretty relative as far as like Garden of Eden and location and so forth. I can tell you it's between the two rivers, you know, Euphrates and Tigris. But with that, the river Euphrates and Tigris, I'm sure they've changed quite a bit. You ever seen the varying changes in the Mississippi River, the Oxbow Lakes and various things that have happened in a short amount of time? We'll talk a lot about that, a little bit, maybe not a lot. So anyway, this is a condensed map of what the Bible addresses. All right, and so what we have here. We have a map on the screen, which is basically what you will study as far as location is concerned in the Bible. The Bible doesn't extend to the United States of America. We are not Mormons. We do not extend to where the so-called lost tribes of the Jews somehow flipped and flopped all the way over to this country and actually became the American Indians, which is not true and false to the core because DNA, genetics, and so forth disprove that quickly. But nonetheless, if I had a laser, I might point to some highlights, but if you can take a look at that map, we're going to be talking a lot about that area. That's where we're at in the Bible. Now, again, just another quick map. I don't know if you can see some of the information there, some of the now names being plugged in. Especially, again, when we get past the flood here, these names and locations become very predominant in your study of the Bible. And it's important to understand, like, for example, this morning, the Tower of Babel. Okay, well, it's really not called the Tower of Babel. It was a city and a tower they built, and probably what was called a ziggurat in that day and age, what was known to be a temple or a shrine that they were going to build and just erect it as high as they could, and it becomes an idol, and God puts an end to that. But the word ziggurat is old word that's used and came down through time, and that's a word that, again, it comes after the flood. But nonetheless, some of these locations, the word Babel, anybody know what the word Babel means? Confusion. You know what the word Babylon means? The same thing. The root is Babylon, is confusion. It's a city of, and the idea and the concept is very interesting when you look at the etymologies, trying to understand how that became, and they were called the Babylonians. So another interesting, maybe, again, you get into a lot of theory here, you have to be careful. That's why I'm kind of cautious in a Bible class like this, because we want to be objective. Do you remember what the Germanic people were called? The Germanic languages were called? Barbarians? Okay, yeah, but in the Bible, you ever heard the word barbarians? That word in the English is, of course, another word that comes from a word that means babblers. And it's because they couldn't understand them. The Romans, the Greeks, the sophisticated Latin-speaking people and so forth, Roman-speaking Greek languages, they looked at those Germanic people as barbarians in the English, but it was actually connected to the way they spoke. They were babblers. So again, a lot of that's in the Bible, but you have to dig a little bit to maybe get the cultural, the context of what's going on here. So again, just another map here. We'll kind of maybe revisit some of this as we go through this class. Now, let's get to it. Let's talk about the Garden of Eden for just a moment. Very interesting study when you look at it from principles and how the concept of Eden, the Garden of Eden, well-watered, those are three ideas, well-watered, Garden of Eden, and Eden. Those words are used throughout the Bible. And they will begin from this point to then take on a spiritual meaning. And that's the point I'll try to point out here. So we look at the Garden of Eden. It's a well-watered, it's a well-fertilized, fertile, perfect place. For me to sit here and talk about what it actually looked like would be about like me trying to do this right here. Have you seen pictures of the supposed ideas of man's mind when it comes to the Garden of Eden? I have no idea what it looked like. My assumption is it was very tropical. It was well watered. And again, we abound with much theory. Well, I don't believe that a Bible class should be based in theory. I believe a Bible class should be based in principles that will help us grow as Christians. And so, let's look at Genesis chapter 1, 2, and 3 just for a moment, because not too long into this Garden of Eden experience, we learn something about man. And so, Genesis chapter 1, of course, what are we detailing and what are we dealing with here in verses 1 through verse 26? Creation. Was anybody there? Except for, Adam and Eve weren't even there, were they? Very interesting that they were put in the garden after the garden was created. When their eyes opened and they saw for the first time and they smelled and they were able to hear the sounds and touch the scenery and the various things and feel and use the senses that God had given them due to creation, can you, again, imagine what that experience, that first experience was? It's very interesting, isn't it? To maybe think what they thought, how the brain started to connect and they started to put things together in their mind. And then think about what do we do? Well, that's the good point to think about. What do we do? God told them what to do. And so really the account of the Garden of Eden is one of instruction. It's one of God instructing Adam and Eve in Genesis 2:15, you read a little bit more insight about the garden, where we see, and the Lord God took the man and put him into the Garden of Eden to dress it and to keep it. To dress it and to keep it. What does that mean? Man, the two first beings, Adam and Eve, what were they supposed to do with the Garden of Eden? That's right. manage it. Become stewards. Learn how to work. You know, there is a sense then in which man has never been without work. It was a blessing though. I don't know about you, but I know about me. But I find fascinating the fact that I can look at my plate of food, and I'm weird, and I look at that steak or that juicy pork chop or whatever it is that we're allowed to eat now, and I go, wow, that used to be on a pig. Okay? I mean, a steak. I mean, I raised that critter. And I took him to the butcher and I patted him on the forehead and I said, thanks. Because that's what God created you for, to help me. Now I took care of him. It doesn't bother me. But God put man in the garden to dress it and to keep it. We human beings, Genesis 1:26, were created in the image of God. And in the image of God were we created. We were created to take the creation that he gave us and be thankful stewards. And that's the lessons that we should draw from all of this. But what happens to Adam and Eve in Genesis chapter 3 when God plants a tree in the midst of the garden and says of that tree, all the other trees you can have, but of this tree, you can't have that tree. Leave it alone. So from the very beginning, what do we learn again about man in God's creation? The Garden of Eden. Even in the Garden of Eden, what do we learn? God put in that garden potentials. He put in that garden opportunities. He put in that garden a test, if you will, for man to prove his love and fidelity to him. But he also created in the sense that there was the potential for man to make a bad choice. He did not create evil. He created in the sense a location, a tree called the tree of knowledge of good and evil. The potentials. Now some have said, well, God's the creator and the origin of evil. No. God's the God of freedom and mercy and grace, and we wouldn't even understand life if he had not put things in place like that. If we were just mere robots and we had no choices to do wrong. Guys, you have to think about the philosophical disadvantage as of a life without those choices. Husbands, loving your wives as Christ loved the church, it's a choice. One of the greatest lessons I ever learned in my life was that love is a choice. You choose to love. Happiness is a choice. You choose to be happy. And then telling your family and telling your children, you choose to be happy. You can overcome. If Joseph, Daniel, and various other characters in the Bible could overcome, then we can too. So those are the lessons that we'll focus on in the Bible. Now, so, what happens in Genesis chapter 3? Very quickly, in verse 1 and following, we're introduced to an antagonist. The antagonist of all mankind. The antagonist that is still today, a roaring lion seeking, roaming around, God allowing that to take place. By the way, there again, God allowing that to take place. But yet in today's era, God has in some sense spiritually by chain or by binding Satan, the roaring lion who takes upon the form of a serpent here in Genesis chapter 3. He has Satan bound by chain according to Revelation chapter 20. He's bound. And the illustration is very interesting. Like a dog on a chain. A dog on a leash, a dog that's bound, as long as you stay without that parameter, that circle where he can roam, stay out of his playing field. Leave him alone. He won't bite you. But he's still there. And there will be a day of judgment. Again, all of this, what we learned from the book of Genesis in chapter 1, if you tie it all together, there's coming a day when this will all be put aside and then we're going to be introduced to a place called heaven. And that's where I want to get kind of more specific with you. For example, now look at what happens to the Garden of Eden. Man sins, right? The woman is seduced, and that's not really the lesson here, but the man follows her lead. Man seems to get a little bit out of step sometimes, not uncommon. And they partake of the fruit, and all of a sudden they realize they're naked. They try to clothe themselves with fig leaves, whatever. I mean, fig leaves can be kind of big, but can you imagine the fig leaves then? I don't know what they look like. Various species and kinds of vegetation, things. But God says what? Is that clothing sufficient? So what does God do? What does God do first and foremost in and around the Garden of Eden? He says, I'm going to have to kill an animal and show you something. So one of the first experiences of sacrifice with the first two people, sacrifice. I ask you a question. Are we still today sacrificing? Do we still as Christians sacrifice? Romans chapter 12 says, present your bodies a, not dead, but living sacrifice. The sacrifice, yes. It's one of the first lessons we learn in the Bible, and it starts in the Garden of Eden. All these lessons. It's a story of redemption then. God coming back. And by the way, I'm no Hebrew linguist. I'm not an expert, and I don't even know what that means sometimes, but I do appreciate and respect scholarly people. But the idea of when God said in the garden, in the day that thou eatest thereof, thou shalt surely die. I am told that the language there is, in the Hebrew, a violent death. In the day thou eatest thereof, the implications of you eating of that fruit, you will die a violent death. Question. In time, do some die violent deaths? Do violent deaths sometimes still take place due to sin, by the way? Death is the result of what? It's not inherited sin, but it is the result of sin and its consequences. Why did Adam and Eve not immediately on the spot die a violent death? I'm not challenging God. I'm trying to point a principle out. It's God that stepped in because of mercy. Now in time, what would happen to Adam and Eve? They would die. Did they die violently? I don't know the answer to that. Did Adam die before the flood or in the flood? Some of those people died in the flood. When we get to Genesis chapter 5 and look at the long extended genealogies, some of those people like Methuselah, when did Methuselah die? Likely in the flood. Was that flood a non-violent situation or a very violent upheaval of natural and miraculous things that took place all at once and then all of a sudden you're not in the ark and you're what? So you think about some of those principles. God does not lie, but God is a God of mercy and love too. For those who will repent of their sins and follow Him, His grace is always sufficient. And so we'll learn about that more too. So these are ideas that come out of the Garden of Eden. Location, what it looks like, I don't know. I'm sure it was a beautiful, perfect place, but now let's look at some passages in the New Testament. Think about the Garden of Eden. Look at something that Moses writes in Genesis chapter 13, verse 10. Talking about Abraham and Lot. Just some kind of interesting hints and references to the Garden of Eden. You remember the story of Abraham and Lot. And returning out of Egypt, and the herdsmen are not getting along because of water and issues of water and so forth. And Abram said to Lot in verse 8, Genesis 13, verse 8, let there be no strife, I pray thee, between me and thee. By the way, this is after the flood. A lot of things have happened. And by the way, Abraham's genealogy and all people's genealogy was connected to people lost, not too far to the flood. And this would have been something that they had been thinking about and known about. Alright, so Abraham said to Lot again, let there be no strife between thee and me and thy herdsmen and my herdsmen and so forth. Is not the whole land, look at verse 9, a reference to geology or geography, Is not the whole land before thee? Separate thyself, I pray thee, from me. If thou wilt take the left hand, then I will take to the right. Or if thou depart to the right hand, then I will go to the left. And Lot lifted up his eyes and beheld all the plains of Jordan. All the plain of Jordan, that it was well watered everywhere before the Lord destroyed Sodom and Gomorrah. Interesting reference to what was going to take place. Even as, what does it say? There's some Bible geography. Even as the garden of the Lord. What's that a reference to? So you reckon Abraham and Lot knew about the Garden of Eden, thought about the well-watered, the fertile Garden of Eden, the beauty, the paradise, the idea of paradise that their ancestors had given up on because of sin, that they had lost. Abraham, the patriarchs, were very familiar with this. Moses writes back about this. Moses writes some 500 years later or so, by inspiration, God put these words in the pen, and Moses writes these words. So Abraham and them recognized the Garden of Eden and knew about it, and look at the way they looked at it in principle. Let's look at a passage in Revelation chapter 2. I've got a lot of the prophets, Isaiah, Jeremiah, Ezekiel, Joel, talk about and use the principle of the Garden of Eden. Look at Revelation chapter 2. Seven churches of Asia Minor here in the story. And church at Ephesus. Look at verse 7. Gets to the end of the story here, the letter to the church at Ephesus. And look at what it says there in verse 7 about the concept, the principle of the Garden of Eden. Anybody want to take a stab at that and read that passage? Yes, sir. Isn't that wonderful? And so the principle of the Garden of Eden takes on a spiritual application for you and me today. You remember when Jesus was on the cross? You remember the next door neighbor on the cross? He said, Lord, save me! And what did the Lord tell that thief? Today, you will be with me in paradise. The concept of paradise, is it connected in principle? Seems to be. If you look at language that's used throughout the prophets, and we're going to run short out of time here, you can look at Isaiah 51, verse 3. If you want to take some notes down, I won't go to all these passages with you. Isaiah 58, verse 11. Ezekiel 31, verse 9. Ezekiel 36, verse 35. Ezekiel 28, verses 12 through 13. Jeremiah 31, verse 12. Joel, minor prophet, chapter 2, verse 3. Those passages all refer to the well-watered, the paradise, the garden, the Eden, so on and so forth. And the concept there, again, a concept, is a concept of paradise. A concept of restoration. What was lost in the beginning will be regained when? Seems to be in twofold sense, in a sense of redemption. The prophets here, Isaiah, Jeremiah, Ezekiel, are pointing towards the New Testament era. We've been redeemed back to the tree of life in the sense that we've been redeemed back through Christ. Christ. And Christ is then the connection with God, the Father. And so we have that connection. Look at Revelation chapter 22. If I didn't get too far away from the book of Revelation. Look at Revelation 22, verses 1 and following. And just, again, think of the language here, the concepts, the principles. And he showed me a pure river of water of life, clear as crystal, proceeding out of the throne of God and of the Lamb. In the midst of the street of it, and on either side of the river, was there the tree of life, which bare 12 manner of fruits, and yielded her fruit every month. And the leaves of the tree were for the healing of the nations. And there shall be no more curse, but the throne of God and of the Lamb shall be in it, and his servants shall serve him. I don't know, but we start with the Garden of Eden in the beginning of the Bible, and we get to the end of the Bible in Revelation, and the concepts of paradise and a perfect place, waters that are crystal clear. Perhaps maybe we'll think a little bit more deeper about the Garden of Eden. Any other comments or questions about the Garden of Eden? We could talk about the rivers Euphrates, the Tigris rivers that are still named and located and have been so for years and years. Kind of generally point into a direction. Someone points out on one map that that's where the Garden of Eden was in between them, and then someone points to another map and says because the rivers have changed course. So do you see why I'm not really going to try and say this is that and that's this and I don't know if this is that? I don't know the benefit of that, okay? So when you read those types of things, just realize that the rivers are still represented from creation, and it's very interesting. Any comments or questions? We're going to move to Noah. Any comments or questions? Okay. Well, another challenge in this course, too, is to study the whole Bible, geographically speaking, and not fail or get behind. This would mean each one of these contexts is rich. I mean, I could spend a whole series talking about in the beginning in the garden. And so I don't want to get bogged down too much. Okay, and I don't want to put you to sleep, but I do hope it's interesting to you. All right, let's talk about the, really in the curriculum, you know, it refers to the landing on the mountains of Ararat. If you look at Genesis chapter 8, verse 4, this is, of course, as things are starting to come to an end, the waters are receding, and all life, land living, animals and so forth have cease to exist, and things are going to have to be restarted from the ark. And what we see in Genesis 8, verse 4, again, a reference by the inspired penman Moses, and it says the ark rested in the seventh month on the 17th day of the month upon the mountains of Ararat. Now, anybody know where the mountains of Ararat are, modern day? Turkey is the best conclusion. That's probably correct. I'm not arguing with it. But with all of these types of locations, there's going to be someone that's going to come out and say, no, I don't believe that's the right mountain. So again, I'm very cautious. But again, commonly accepted, modern day Turkey location, that is the mountains of Ararat, or just a small view. Anybody stood and looked at the mountains of, you got mountains in Mexico, you got mountains up in Montana, you got mountains up in Alaska. I've never seen Mount Everest, but I hear it's amazing. You die if you climb it. So, that's supposedly Ararat right there. And I don't disagree with that. So when you think about this particular, story, is the story of Noah about the mountains of Ararat? It's not about that, is it? So what is the story about? Is the story about those who find an anomaly up in the mountains of Ararat? You see that shape? 515 feet long. It's a rock structure mostly. I mean, might be some earthen wood or some types of materials that they found, but a lot of people like to say that that right there, I suppose, would be some type of a fossilized belly of the ark. Now, I hesitate to even show you that, But the reason I did is because you're going to find it yourself. It's everybody. I mean, it's out there. And that's what they call, geologists, I think, call that an anomaly, a rock formation of such up in the mountains of Ararat. And what do you think some people want that to be? And I phrase that the way I wanted to phrase that. What do you think some people want that to be? They want that to be the ark. Okay. Now, if that were the ark, is that interesting? Sure. Suppose it'd be interesting. But if it's not, is the story any less valid? You know, it's amazing to me, again, globally speaking in this world, how many languages, how many cultures have some kind of a flood story? The story of the flood. Anybody remember what was said in that Is Genesis history? I thought was interesting. I'd never heard it this way. But one of the arguments against the flood of Noah is the peaks of the mountains. They're too tall. You mean to tell me that what Mount Everest is 24-something thousand feet high or something like that? Maybe more. Yeah, I think 24 seems to be my mind. And what a lot of skeptics, atheists, over there, there's just no way. 24,000 feet of water and so forth. Well, one of the things pointed out is, again, the elevations have changed. They've risen. Anybody been to Hawaii lately and seen how fast those peaks are growing over there? Things change, don't they? Anybody ever been to Yellowstone? They tell me, I don't know, that thing's rising. It's in a constant state of elevation rising. And yearly, you can measure it. I don't know. That's just not my thing. I just go over there and watch those mud pots, and I go, wow, that's pretty cool. But then I'm more interested in the animals, personally. My mom is the one that's into all that other stuff. I just think it's amazing, you know. I mean, but things are changing. So you see the point. So what Mount Everest is today was likely not what it was 4,000 or 5,000 years ago. There you go. Anybody ever flown over in an airplane? Not like a bird. The Grand Canyon? I don't know about you. The first time I flew over the Grand Canyon, I went, wow, that is grand. But what I realized was when I saw it, what was the first thing you maybe noticed when you saw it down there, that old sandy, deserty type of ground? Something moved all that dirt and sand out of there. That water moved all that. And it happened fast. And so, there's no, again, concern with whether the Bible is right or wrong. The Bible's right. The mountains of Ararat. I don't know, again, much more to talk about. If I'm going to talk about Noah in his day, what am I going to talk about? Let's go back to Noah just for a minute. I'm talking about sin. I'm talking about people that had turned their backs on God. And we're talking about redemption all over again, because how many souls were saved? And they were saved by what? And we're saved by what today? Do you see redemption here? Water. So we could talk about the earth and the structure and the geography. I want to point it out, and I want you to see that these are things that people are... And I think it's fascinating that people are constantly looking for these evidences. Nothing wrong with that. But whether that is or isn't, and I don't believe it is personally, from what I've read, I believe it's an anomaly. Because I don't know about you, unless that gopher wood is some really time-resistant material, most, unless under very special circumstances, does not fossilize, it does what? It doesn't last very long. Okay? You get a couple hundred years, 500 years, 1,000 years out of wood, and you're, again, special circumstances. So again, doesn't matter. All right? Now, I'm on par for the course. Any questions on Noah? I mean, we spent a lot of time talking about Noah. We're going to probably, in this class, come back and hit stuff. This is kind of introductory, and I'm just trying to lay the foundation. And personally, I'm trying to get past Noah's flood, because a lot of things have changed. Okay? And now we're getting a little bit more past the flood and talking about, again, some other interesting things that we can apply spiritually very easily. The Tower of Babel, chapter 11, post-Noah's flood. You know what the Tower of Babel is today? We're all speaking one language, right? I can even speak Spanish if I go to my computer. Because I can click the little button that says see translation. And then it tells me to rate this translation. And I usually say not very good. If that's the way they speak, that's not the way I speak. The Tower of Babel today, you know what it is? Internet, social media, the ability to connect in one language. Question. Internet's a wonderful tool? That's not a question, that's a statement. I believe it's a wonderful tool. I need it, use it every day. But how much evil and wicked is being created through internet? The ability to Google this, Google that, I mean, and immediately look up. How many people are looking up things that are edifying, educational, but how many people are looking up things that are ungodly and sinful? I don't know, I don't do that stuff, but I hear that statistically speaking that there are billions of pornographic type stuff. I don't know. I mean, every now and then that picture pops up and you're like, where'd that come from? Due to some advertising or something? I don't know. So, just something to think about. I wrote an article one time about the Tower of Babel today. It's come back. It's the internet. People today can all speak, and what are they doing with this language? What were they doing here in Genesis chapter 11 when they were still able to speak one language? Were they glorifying God? Trying to make a name for themselves? Let's build a tower up to God as high as we can. I don't know when the pyramids were built, and I just throw that out there because you can still today find amazing structures that people have built, showing the again, the ingenuity of man. Who put that in man? God did. I don't doubt the Tower of Babel. I don't know where it was exactly. I can kind of talk about Shinar. Look at Genesis 11, verse 4, so I at least cover the material. And it's actually verses 1 through 4. I see Brother Belton getting up. That means I've got to step up. The whole earth was of one language. What's the story of the Tower of Babel? I think it starts right there with that first phrase. The whole earth was of one language. There's implications in that statement. That's kind of like, wow, really? And what were they doing with the one language? God gave people language. He gave them the ability to speak, by the way, and communicate, understand. And they came to pass as they journeyed from the east, they found a plain in the land of Shinar. There's a lot of debate on where that's at. You might have a Bible map in your Bible that says one thing, but Gina and I, my wife, we were considering various maps, and there's not a lot of congruency on where exactly some of these locations are. What we do know is during this day and age, people were starting to build. And they were starting to build what, again, were called ziggurats. If you take Western or world civilization in college. Anybody ever remember your college professor talking about the ziggurats, the first religious types of temples and stuff being built? I don't know why they called it ziggurats. Don't ask me that. It's just a word. If you look it up, that's what they talk about. Lots of religious. The one thing that stands out is that all of these things were not atheistic. They're all some type of a structure that seems to have some religious significance. Okay? The Tower of Babel. We're speaking one language. Let's build this great tower, make a name for ourselves. Let's go up here and challenge God. We're down here on the earth. I've always envisioned it like this, the people wanting to climb to the top of the pyramid, because I don't know what the Tower of Babel looked like. They got up to the temple or the pyramid, and you had a Pharaoh up there going, shaking his fist at God, because they'd started so wide, and just eventually you come to a point. Now, someone drew all that out, but then perhaps they were thinking, perhaps. Well, let's go out here and let's build it even wider. And someone says, well, you know that land's not level. So we're going to have to build the footer on this side way up to get it to be level if you want to keep going higher and higher and higher and higher to get to the heavens. But in my mind, I see these people that are of that persuasion. I'm not of that persuasion. I could care less about living up in a high rise. I'm fine right here on this flat ground. But the people that want to do that, in my mind, are the type of people that are in principle, you know, a lot more ego than perhaps I have. Again, I used words. You want to be an architect and build amazing buildings? I'm not saying you can't do that. But I am saying your motive had better be pure, because God wins and man-made structures always crumble. So the Tower of Babel, another thing we need to talk about here, I know my time is gone, in this, what does the word Babel mean? It's not really called the Tower of Babel, by the way. Babel is what they, look at the language here of the Bible. Let's just look at through verse 9. Verse 9 is where you get the word Babel. God, look at verse 7. Fascinating here. Here again is this plural pronoun. Verse 7. Go to, let, what's it say there? Us. Go down and there confound their language that they may not understand one another's speech. What did the prophet Hosea say in Hosea 4 verse 6? My people are destroyed for a lack of knowledge. God wants us to understand and be knowledgeable. All right, then look at verse 8. So the Lord scattered them abroad from thence upon the face of all the earth, and they left off to build the city. Therefore is the name of it called Babel. And what does Babel mean? Confusion. Confusion. Because the Lord did there confound the language of all the earth, and from thence did the Lord scatter them abroad. Probably going to run out of time. I've got quite a bit of material on the idea of language and speaking one language. But I do want to say something here regarding this idea. It's an article on language and linguists. Secular linguists are puzzled by the existence of 20 or so language families in the world today. They're puzzled because within each family or language, the people that speak them, have been shown to be genetically related, but few genetic links have been observed between families. This is a problem for secular linguists. If, as they believe, man evolved from an ape-like ancestor, man would at some point have gained the ability to speak, at some point. This process of change would actually be superbly dangerous, as they admit. But still, if speech did evolve somewhere, somehow, we would expect to find that all languages are genetically related. They are clearly not. They are clearly not. Some have therefore suggested that man evolved speech simultaneously in more than one place. This suggestion is beyond belief, considering the dangers involved in the supposed evolution of speech. So how did the language families come into existence? Only Genesis provides a credible explanation. It records how God gave the people new languages to speak. Question. Anybody that would doubt that? What did the apostles do on the day of Pentecost immediately by the gift of the Holy Spirit? Parthians, Medes, Elamites, dwellers of Mesopotamia, and all the known world, Rome. And what is said in Acts chapter 2 immediately? We do hear them all speak in our language the wonderful works of God. Languages. Tower of Babel. When I think of the Tower of Babel, I think of the fact that indeed God is not the author of confusion in 1 Corinthians 14. I know my time's up. 1 minute. 1 Corinthians chapter 14, verse 37 through 40, God is the author of peace, not confusion. Zephaniah chapter 3, the prophet, little old prophet Zephaniah, know very little about him. Zephaniah chapter 3, verse 9, the prophet recorded that God would restore a pure language for the people. what is that pure language today that we're all supposed to be speaking? And it's not Facebook. It's not social media. It's not internet. What is the one pure language today that unites people and makes them godly? The gospel. The gospel. The spirit of truth, various other synonyms we could probably find. So when I think about the Tower of Babel, I can show you a picture of all the fanciful ideas of man and the art and so forth. And it's very cool, I guess you might say, in today's world. But I have no idea. I can tell you what it was about, though, and I can tell you the principles of the Scripture and help us be better Christians and prepared as it relates to locations in the Bible. Okay, comments or questions? I thank you so much for your attention.